Hello there. My name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next hour, I will be reading you the news headlines from the BBC World News for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. So we're already into April. We've passed the Easter weekend. If you're in the Massachusetts area, you might actually have seen a little snow flurries this morning, but I don't think they're going to amount to anything. So we are going to jump into the news right away and see how many articles we can cover over the next hour. The headline for the first article we will read is "Little Sign of Breakthrough as Trump's Iran Deadline Nears." U.S. President Donald Trump has set deadlines, made demands, and issued threats over the course of the five-week joint U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, but seldom have they been this explicit. The new round of strikes against Iran will be devastating. They will begin at 20 hours or 8 o'clock Washington, D.C. time on Tuesday. Within 4 hours, every bridge and power plant in the nation will be decimated. Very little is off limits, Trump said on Monday. To avoid this fate, according to the president, Iran has to make a deal, quote, "that's acceptable to me." A component of the agreement should include free traffic of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. As the final hours tick down, there has been little indication that Iran is ready to agree to Trump's ultimatum. They have rejected a temporary ceasefire and issued their own list of demands, which a U.S. official described as maximalist. This places the U.S. president in a delicate position. If there is no agreement, Trump could extend his deadline for the fourth time in the past 3 weeks. But backing away after such detailed threats, punctuated with expletives and dire warnings, could undercut his credibility as the war grinds on. It is possible Iran and the rest of the world could conclude that despite America's military might and tactical skill, readily displayed in this weekend's intricate operation to rescue two downed airmen deep in Iran, it is not negotiating from a clear position of strength. "We won," Trump insisted during a news conference on Monday afternoon. "They are militarily defeated. The only thing they have is the psychology of, oh, we're going to drop a couple of mines in the water." That psychology, the ability to deter oil tankers from moving through the Strait of Hormuz with drones, missiles, and mines, may be a more potent Iranian asset than the U.S. has been willing to acknowledge. During Monday's news conference, Trump marveled at U.S. military precision on display in last year's midnight hammer bombing raid on Iran's nuclear sites, the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January, and this weekend's rescue mission. He and his national security team celebrated that most recent effort, which included coordinating hundreds of aircraft and elite military personnel and employing misdirection and technological wizardry. But the effort, while remarkable, was to avoid what Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth acknowledged was a potential tragedy. Even if that tragedy had been averted, the triumphant rescue underlined the risk U.S. forces still face in Iran, and the president may be learning that U.S. military power has its limits. "We can bomb the hell out of them," he said. "We can knock them for a loop. But to close the strait, all you need is one terrorist." The other option is for Trump to follow through with his threats. On multiple occasions on Monday, he said that was a course he did not want to pursue. While Trump said that the Iranian people were willing to endure the ongoing U.S. military campaign and, in fact, welcomed the bombs falling on their cities, he also acknowledged that anything the U.S. destroys now would eventually have to be rebuilt and that the U.S. might ultimately contribute to that rebuilding effort. "Do I want to destroy their infrastructure? No," he said. "Right now, if we leave today, it will take them 20 years to rebuild their country." He added that if he followed through with his bombing threats, the rebuilding effort would take a century. It's not exactly the Stone Age that he has warned Iran would be reduced to, but an ensuing humanitarian crisis, including the regional impact of the crushing retaliation that Iran has promised, could be devastating. Even in this late hour, however, Trump continues to hold out hope of a breakthrough. "We have an active, willing participant on the other side," he said. "They would like to be able to make a deal. I can't say any more than that." With the stakes as high as they are, the president's opacity is notable. "He has a plan. Every single thing has been thought out by all of us," he said on Monday, "but he won't divulge it." It could be an indication that behind-the-scenes negotiations are farther along than have been publicly acknowledged, or it could be some combination of bluff and wishful thinking. "They have till tomorrow," Trump said. "We'll see what happens. I believe they're negotiating in good faith. I guess we will find out." So that's a update from the perspective of the president. There is a deadline that he set for today. Tonight, actually. And we will see what happens. I will say, just listening to the news this morning, that the United States military is bombing some part of Iran actually this morning. So we shall see what happens with that. The second story we're going to read with regard to Iran is this rescue of the U.S. airmen. Interesting story that came out into the public knowledge over the weekend. The headline of this story reads, "How the rescue of U.S. airmen in a remote part of Iran unfolded." U.S. Special Forces launched a high-stakes raid into Iran on Sunday to rescue an injured airman left stranded in a remote mountainous region after his aircraft was shot down 2 days earlier. Details have emerged about how the U.S. raced against the clock at advancing Iranian operatives to find the officer deep inside hostile territory. The airman's ordeal began on Friday when an F-15E Strike Eagle jet was shot down over southwestern Iran, the first incident of its kind in more than 20 years. The two U.S. military personnel on board ejected, and while the pilot was rescued the same day, the second crew member, a weapons operator, became separated and remained stranded in a sparsely populated, rugged region. Official confirmation soon followed swirling reports that a U.S. airman was missing inside a war zone. While U.S. aircraft were seen flying low over the area on Saturday, Iran offered a bounty of $66,000 to anyone who found him alive, and videos shared on social media, which have not been verified by the BBC, appeared to show armed civilians searching for him. The airman was armed with a handgun, U.S. officials said, and would have received training for this situation, which involves intermittently turning on a beacon signal to help locate him, getting to high ground, establishing communications, and concealing himself. The crew member hid in a mountain crevice and restricted the use of his beacon signal out of concern it could be picked up by Iran, Trump administration officials confirmed at a news conference on Monday. A senior Trump administration official said the CIA was able to trace the airman's exact location and informed the Pentagon, which would have also had to rule out the possibility the beacon signal was an Iranian trap. U.S. President Donald Trump later said the airman's location was monitored 24 hours a day as he was being hunted down by our enemies who were getting closer and closer by the hour. At Monday's news conference, the president said the U.S. soldier was severely injured, treated his own wounds, and, while bleeding profusely, scaled mountains to transmit his location. The CIA also reportedly ran a deception campaign inside Iran, falsely spreading word that U.S. forces had already found him. As U.S. special forces aboard several aircraft made their way toward the stranded officer, strikes were reportedly launched to keep Iranian troops away from the area. The New York Times reported that the airman communicated information on Iranian positions from his hiding place high on a 7,000-foot ridge to aid with those airstrikes. CBS News reported that Navy SEALs, highly trained special operations troops, were then airdropped in to recover the airman. Excuse me. The rescue mission involved 155 aircraft, including four bombers, 64 fighters and 48 refueling tankers, 13 rescue aircraft, and more, Trump said. We were bringing them all over, and a lot of it was subterfuge, he said. We wanted to have them think he was in a different location because they had a vast military force out there. Thousands of people were looking for him. But their departure was not straightforward. Two planes tasked with retrieving rescue crews became bogged down in soil and were unable to take off from the remote base in Iran they had used to land, CBS reported. U.S. officials said the planes were destroyed to keep them out of enemy hands, standard practice for the military. Footage and photos assessed by BBC Verify appeared to show a smoldering aircraft wreckage in a mountainous area of central Iran, about 30 miles southeast of the city of Isfahan. Iran's military said two U.S. C-130 military transport planes and two Black Hawk helicopters were destroyed during the operation, and that a deception and escape mission at an abandoned airport in southern Isfahan was completely foiled. But U.S. officials have denied they came under attack. Iranian state media also said on Sunday that troops over the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps had shot down a U.S. drone over Isfahan while it was searching for the missing man. BBC News has not been able to confirm either version of events. U.S. Special Forces left Iran on three extra aircraft sent to collect the crews, with one official telling CBS a rudimentary airfield in Iran was utilized for the operation. The rescued airman landed in Kuwait for medical treatment. Trump said he was seriously wounded but will be just fine. Further details about the airman's identity have not been disclosed. Just before 4 a.m. GMT on Sunday, U.S. media broke the news that the second pilot had been rescued. An Israeli intelligence official told the Jerusalem Post that the IDF had assisted with the operation, including by launching strikes designed to act as a diversion, drawing Iranian security forces away from the crash site and toward other areas. Iranian officials and state-run media have painted the operation as a failure, with Ibrahim Zolfari, a spokesman for the Iran's main military command, saying several U.S. military aircraft had been forced to make emergency landings. He said the ignorant president, trapped in the swamp of the war and aggression that he himself started, fully realized that any aggression, ground operation, or infiltration would face decisive and disgraceful defeat. Some U.S. analysts have described the loss of an F-15 deep inside Iranian territory, followed by the destruction of several rescue aircraft, as showing the limitations of U.S. air superiority. General Frank McKenzie, a former commander of the U.S. Central Command, said we did, in fact, lose a couple of aircraft in that mission, but added that he would take that loss any day in a situation like this. It takes years to build an aircraft. It takes 200 years to build a military tradition where you don't leave anybody behind, he told CBS News. So, pretty interesting story about the rescue of that U.S. airman. All right, we'll take a look at some other stories dominating the news today. The headline of this story is Australia's most decorated living soldier charged over alleged war crimes. Australia's most decorated living soldier has been charged over allegations he committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Ben Roberts Smith, who left the Defence Force in 2013, was arrested at Sydney Airport on Tuesday and will face court over five counts of the war crime of murder. He will spend the night in a cell before a bail hearing on Wednesday. A defamation judgment in 2023 found the former corporal in Australia's Special Air Service Regiment had killed several unarmed Afghans. The 47-year-old Victoria Cross recipient denies all wrongdoing and has previously said that the allegations against him, which have not yet been assessed at a criminal standard, were egregious and spiteful. The civil trial was the first time in the history any court has examined claims of war crimes by Australian forces. Roberts Smith argued that the alleged killings occurred legally during combat or did not happen at all, and last year lost an appeal against the federal court finding. At a news conference in Sydney on Tuesday, the Australian Federal Police confirmed a 47-year-old former soldier had been arrested and said he would be charged with killing unarmed detainees while serving in Afghanistan between 2009 and 2012. He faces one charge of the war crime of murder, one of jointly commissioning a murder, and three of aiding, abetting, counseling, or procuring a murder. It will be alleged the victims were shot by the accused or shot by subordinate members of the Australian Defence Force in the presence of and acting on the orders of the accused, Commissioner Chrissy Barrett said. In 2020, a landmark investigation known as the Brereton Report found credible evidence that elite Australian soldiers unlawfully killed 39 people in Afghanistan, recommending 19 current or former ADF members be investigated. A specialist team called the Office of the Special Investigator was set up to do so. It has charged only one other person so far. Ross Barrett, the Director of Investigations at OSI, said Roberts Smith's arrest was a significant step under challenging circumstances. The OSI has been tasked with investigating literally dozens of murders alleged to have been committed in the middle of a war zone in a country 9,000 kilometers from Australia, he said. We can't go to that country. We don't have access to the crime scenes. We don't have photographs, site plans, measurements, the recovery of projectiles, blood spatter analysis. We don't have access to the deceased. Barrett added that allegations of misconduct were confined to a very small section of our trusted and respected ADF. The majority of the ADF do our country proud, she said. Earlier on Tuesday, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said he would not comment on the case as it is before the courts. It is very important that there not be a political engagement, he said. In a statement, the Australian War Memorial has said it will again review its Ben Roberts Smith exhibit. A plaque accompanying a display of his uniforms and medals have been repeatedly updated to reflect the allegations and the outcome of his defamation case. At the time, nine newspapers first reported allegations in 2018, Roberts Smith was considered a national hero, having been awarded Australia's highest military honor for single-handedly overpowering Taliban fighters attacking his SAS platoon. In a bid to clear his name, he launched a high-profile legal battle, which spanned 7 years, cost millions of dollars, and was dubbed by some as Australia's trial of the century. However, a federal court judge found, on the balance of probabilities, that Roberts Smith had taken part in at least four murders, a judgment upheld on appeal. Anthony Basanko found that Roberts Smith had twice ordered unarmed men be shot dead to blood rookie soldiers and was involved in the deaths of a handcuffed farmer he kicked off a cliff and a captured Taliban fighter whose prosthetic leg was taken as a trophy and later used by troops as a drinking vessel. So, pretty disturbing story to come out of Australia. One of their most decorated soldiers has now been accused of war crimes. This next headline reads, J.D. Vance arrives in Hungary to back Orbán's re-election bid. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance has traveled to Budapest to back veteran Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, a key European ally of the Trump administration, ahead of tough parliamentary elections on Sunday. Vance is expected to take part in a joint press conference before addressing an election rally with Orbán in a football stadium on Tuesday afternoon. The April 12th election is billed as Orbán's toughest challenge in a political career going back almost 40 years. He has won four elections in a row since 2010. Vance and his wife Usha were welcomed by Foreign Minister Peter Zarado, who told Hungarian media that Orbán's friendship with President Donald Trump had created a new golden age in relations. Last month, Trump said that Orbán had his complete and total support in a video message to the Hungarian Conservative Political Action Conference in Budapest. On Sunday, Orbán faces Peter Magyar, a former insider in the Prime Minister's Fidesz party, who broke with him 2 years ago to find the center-right Tzaza party. Tzaza leads Fidesz by between 10 and 20% in most polls. Only the strongly pro-government Nezopont agency puts Fidesz narrowly ahead. Orbán is hoping that Vance's visit will impress undecided Hungarian voters enough to back him once again as a strong and internationally respected leader in turbulent times. I'm looking forward to seeing my good friend Victor, and we'll talk about any number of things related to the U.S.-Hungary relationship, Vance told reporters as he left Washington earlier. Officials are painting his two-day trip as the first top-level U.S. visit since former President George Bush in 2006, although Secretary of State Marco Rubio met Orbán in Budapest in February. Orbán has strong ties to the U.S. MAGA movement, backing the American president, who said last month, "I hope he wins, and I hope he wins big." Their friendship goes back to 2016, when Orbán was the first and only EU leader to support him in the U.S. presidential election. He strongly backed Trump for re-election in 2024 and was in Washington last October to secure an exemption for Hungary from U.S. sanctions on Russian oil giants Rosneft and Lukoil. Trump later made clear that the exemption was a personal deal between himself and Orbán, implying that if Orbán lost this election, his successor would have to reapply. Hungary, alone among EU countries, has defied calls from Brussels to wean itself off Russian fossil fuels. In Washington, Orbán also committed to buying more U.S. liquefied natural gas, as well as U.S. nuclear technology and fuel. Hungary depends heavily on Russian oil through the Druzhba pipeline from the east and on Russian gas through the Turk Stream pipeline from the south. Both sources are now problematic. No oil has reached Hungary through the Druzhba pipeline, which crosses Ukraine, since the end of January. Orbán blames Ukraine for failing to restore the pipeline after a Russian attack on oil infrastructure in western Ukraine on January 27th. Interestingly, there has been no visible diplomatic support for the Hungarian government from the Trump administration on the pipeline issue. To prevent shortages, Hungary has been forced to release fuel reserves and import non-Russian oil through an alternative pipeline from Croatia. A new problem emerged on Sunday when the Serbian government, Hungary's neighbor to the south, announced that explosives had been found and neutralized near the Turk Stream gas pipeline close to the border with Hungary. Orbán and pro-government media labeled the incident a terror attack on Hungary's energy supply, but former intelligence sources in Hungary and the opposition leader, Peter Magyar, accused Orbán of staging the incident with the help of Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić to boost his chances for re-election on Sunday. Orbán has made hostility to Ukraine and its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, a cornerstone of his election campaign. Other recent scandals also appear to have dented his popularity. Private telephone conversations between Foreign Minister Zajarto and top Russian officials over several years have been leaked. Transcripts suggest that Zajarto regularly keeps the Russian government informed about confidential discussions at East European Union summits and lobbied to get Russian officials off the sanctioned list at Moscow's bidding. Zajarto has defended the calls as normal diplomacy. So interesting, the election for the Prime Minister of Hungary is this Sunday, and it will be interesting to see the impact of the Trump administration's endorsement through the presence of Vice President J.D. Vance. If you're a NASA space fan, you have been thrilled over the last few days. The Artemis II mission has been a success so far. The headline of this story reads, Artemis II crew head home after traveling further from Earth than anyone before. Four astronauts on NASA's Artemis II mission are on their way back home after a dramatic lunar flyby that saw them travel further from Earth than any other humans. The crew lost contact with the Earth as expected for 40 minutes as they traveled behind the moon. With communications reestablished, astronaut Christina Koch said, "It's so great to hear Earth again." Soon afterwards, the spacecraft dipped to within a few thousand miles of the lunar surface, and the crew witnessed a total eclipse of the sun as the moon blocked out its light. The Artemis II mission's spacecraft, Orion, broke the record for human travel at about 1356 Eastern Daylight Time on Monday, beating a record of 248,655 miles held since 1970 by the Apollo 13 mission. Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen acknowledged the achievement with humility. "As we surpass the furthest distance humans have ever traveled from planet Earth, we do so in honoring the extraordinary efforts and feats of our predecessors in human space exploration," Hansen said. As the spacecraft approached and the moon swelled in its windows, the astronauts began working through a checklist of things to record on its surface, taking images with an array of digital cameras and, as NASA had briefed, making sketches and recording their own audio descriptions of what they saw. The spacecraft was not planning to land on the moon, but fly around its far side, the side which is never visible from Earth. Satellites have photographed the far side before, but the astronauts were the first human eyes to see some parts of the far side's surface and its vast craters and lava plains. After the flyby, President Trump spoke with the Orion team and congratulated them. "Today you have made history and made all America really proud, incredibly proud." He went on to ask the four astronauts what the most unforgettable part of their day had been. Commander Reid Wiseman told the president, "We saw sights that no human has ever seen, not even Apollo, and that was amazing for us." Fellow astronaut Jeremy Hansen made a request to NASA Mission Control to name two craters they observed on the moon, both with our naked eye and with our long lens. One they asked to be called Integrity, the name the astronauts gave to the Orion capsule that they are traveling in. The other request was to commemorate Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died in 2020 of cancer. "A number of years ago, we started this journey and we lost a loved one. And there's a feature on a really neat place on the moon. At certain times of the moon's transit around Earth, we will be able to see this from Earth," he said in a visibly emotional tribute. The four astronauts were seen hugging on the live feed from their capsule after the request. The crew's kit included two professional digital SLR cameras, one fitted with a wide-angle lens to capture the whole scene, another with a powerful zoom to pick out fine detail on the lunar surface, plus a mirrorless camera with a standard view lens designed to produce images with a perspective close to that of the human eye. Small rugged video cameras mounted on the tips of each of Orion's four solar array wings recorded smooth, continuous views as the spacecraft swept over the moon's cratered landscape, while each astronaut also carried a smartphone to film and photograph everyday life inside the space capsule. NASA said it plans to share much of the imagery either later in the mission or when the spacecraft returns to Earth. During the six-hour flyby, the crew dimmed Orion's internal lights to reduce reflections on the windows and improve their view. NASA's science team say the audio will matter as much as the imagery, as the astronauts say what they see while looking out. Trained human eyes can sometimes pick out subtle colors, contrasts, and textures that do not stand out in spacecraft images alone. Dr. Kelsey Young, the agency's lunar science lead, told the BBC News, that a well-trained observer could detect faint shades in the landscape, the nuances of color, texture, and geological features on the far side that became clearer the longer they stared at the moon from close up. Human eyes and brains are highly sensitive to subtle changes in color, texture, and other surface characteristics, she said. The night's most nerve-jangling phrase came as the Orion craft slipped behind the bulk of the moon. Its radio and laser connections to Earth were cut off, leaving the four astronauts alone on the lunar far side for about 40 minutes. Just before this loss of signal, pilot Victor Glover had a message for the people on Earth. As we prepare to go out of radio communication, we're still going to feel your love from Earth. And to all of you down there on Earth and around the Earth, we love you from the moon. We will see you on the other side. For the next 40 minutes, mission controllers, the astronauts' friends and families, and those watching the live stream waited anxiously as the mission clock ticked down to the moment when contact should have been restored. When the signal finally did flicker back to life, there was a long silence before the voice of Christina Koch crackled back to mission control, evoking memories of the Apollo era. We will explore, we will build ships, we will visit again, we will construct science outposts, we will drive rovers, we will do radio astronomy, we will found companies, we will bolster industry, we will inspire. But ultimately, we will always choose Earth, we will always choose each other. From about 20-35 hours, the sun as seen from the capsule began to change as the moon moved to eclipse it. What was left was a portion of the sun's shimmering atmosphere called the corona, poking out from the lower portion of the moon, which is usually drowned in glare. Glover was moved by what he saw. It is amazing the brightness where the sunset is still bright and you still have a distinct Earth shine. For NASA, Moon Day was just not theater. It was about putting the Orion spacecraft through its paces to see if it could cope for future missions. Artemis II is a test flight ahead of more ambitious goals, including landing humans on the moon for the first time since 1972 and ultimately sending humans to Mars. Sensors on Orion recorded how its power and thermal systems coped for nearly an hour without direct sunlight and with rapid swings in heating and cooling as it moved through the eclipse. Orion had made its closest sweep past the moon, endured its spell of isolation, watched an eclipse in the black, and then let lunar gravity bend its path back towards Earth. The crew now faced several quieter days of checks and experiments before a final ordeal, a fiery plunge through the atmosphere at nearly 25,000 miles per hour, and a parachute splashdown into the Pacific that will test the capsule's heat shield and recovery systems. So a pretty remarkable space mission ongoing as we speak. And it is just amazing to think that they traveled farther from Earth than anybody has ever done. This is an interesting headline of a story. The headline reads, more than 1,700 Brits who fell ill in Cape Verde join action against TUI. More than 1,700 people have now joined the legal action against travel company TUI. After becoming ill while on holiday in the Cape Verde Islands, lawyers have told the BBC. Lawyers from Irwin Mitchell, who are leading the personal injury claim, say they have been contacted by people who became ill there as recently as 2 weeks ago. They believe at least 8 Britons have now died after holidays there in recent years. In February, UK health officials warned Britons over travel to the West African archipelago following reports of stomach bugs. TUI is investigating the claims and said it was deeply saddened by the reports of these tragic losses, with customer health and safety its highest priority. It said it did not yet have access to the full Cape Verde health report, which remains unpublished. Jatinder Paul from Irwin Mitchell Solicitors told the BBC Breakfast, In all my years of doing this work, I have not seen a case this large, and unfortunately so many that have died as a result of the illnesses. We are pursuing all our cases against TUI. They had a responsibility in taking our clients away on a package holiday, which was not going to cause them any illness. Unfortunately, it was the opposite of that. Paul added, if we are unable to resolve them amicably, we expect a judge in the High Court to make an order which would involve payment of millions of pounds worth of damages to our clients. Irwin Mitchell's solicitors said its clients had reported contracting gastric illnesses such as E. coli, Salmonella, and Shigella, and parasitic infections such as Cryptosporidium. Those affected include children as young as 6 months old, it reported. In February, an investigation by the UK Health Security Agency found that since October 2025, there had been 112 reported cases of Shigella and 43 of Salmonella linked to travel to Cape Verde. Shigella and Salmonella are gastrointestinal infections which can cause diarrhea, stomach cramps, and fever. Cape Verde, a former Portuguese colony, is a popular holiday destination due to its golden beaches and year-round warm weather. Since 2022, TUI has taken more than 1 million holidaymakers to Cape Verde. Lawyers say they have been gathering evidence of issues at some hotels in the country. Footage seen by the BBC shows what appears to be undercooked food, buffets surrounded by flies and mold in the rooms. Previously, lawyers said 6 Britons had died after holidays in Cape Verde since January 2023, but they now believe 8 people have died. Elena Walsh and her family from Birmingham were among those who booked a package holiday to the island through TUI last year. The 64-year-old had been staying at the 5-star Riu Cabo Verde Resort when she started to feel unwell on August 8th last year. Walsh was taken to the hospital, where she died on August 10th. Her son, Sean Walsh, said his mother had become ill very quickly. Through the night, we were there with her trying to see if she'd pull out of it, but she just deteriorated, he told the BBC Breakfast. He added, I just want people to not go there, because yes, people can go on holidays there and come back and be fine, but my mom didn't. If people are willing to run that risk, then go for it, but I'd say to people, don't. Riu Hotels and Resorts said the health and safety of guests were its main priority, adding, our hotels in Cape Verde followed the strictest international health and hygiene standards certified by external prestigious consultancy firms specialized in health and safety. Karen Pooley from Lindy died in October after traveling to Cape Verde for a 2-week holiday she had booked through TUI. She became unwell on October 11th with gastric symptoms, and while running to the bathroom to be sick the next day, she slipped on water leaking from her fridge and broke her leg. Pooley, 64 years old, was airlifted from a clinic in Cape Verde to Tenerife on October 16th and died the next day from sepsis and multiple organ failure. Liz Pooley, Karen's daughter, said she blamed TUI for her mother's death. She told the BBC, no family should go through this, no family should have to FaceTime their mum on a Friday night, and by the following Friday, organize a funeral. TUI said in a statement that it could not comment on individual cases, but that customer health and safety is always our highest priority. We have established procedures in place to support any customer who becomes unwell while on holiday, including access to appropriate medical care and assistance in resort. To provide that support, it is important that illness is reported to our teams while customers are in destination. Where this does not happen, it limits the assistance we are able to offer at the time. We continue to follow UK Foreign Office advice and engage with hotel partners and relevant authorities where appropriate. So interesting. Many people from the UK have been on holiday, in Cape Verde, and several of them apparently have suffered some form of illness, with as many as 8 people having died. Be interesting to see. I'm not sure how they sue the travel agency, but that's what they're doing. So we'll see how that works out. The headline of this story is one dead as a train traveling 99 miles per hour collides with a lorry in France. A train driver has died after his high-speed passenger train collided with a lorry at a level crossing in France while traveling at an estimated 99 miles per hour. The incident took place shortly before 7 a.m. on Tuesday morning between Béthune and Lens in the northern Pas-de-Calais region. Two people initially deemed to have sustained critical injuries following the crash were doing well, while 13 others sustained minor injuries, according to local authorities. The driver of the lorry, which was carrying military equipment at the time, is in police custody, but officials said it was too early to determine the cause. An investigation into potential aggravated manslaughter is underway. The vehicle belonged to a commercial hauler, and the driver was not a member of the military, officials said. The train had been traveling from Dunkirk to Paris when the collision occurred. After hitting the lorry, it continued moving for several hundred meters before coming to a stop. One person staying nearby told regional newspaper La Voix de Neu that they heard the train's horn blaring for about 8 to 10 seconds before the crash occurred. Max, who was staying around 500 meters from the collision site, said the windows of the house rattled from the impact. The CEO of France's state-owned rail operator, Jean Castex, confirmed the train driver had been a 56-year-old long-term employee of the company at a news conference on Tuesday. "My first thoughts go to his family, his loved ones, and colleagues," he said. "I also want to pay tribute to the two train staff members who were on board and who calmly stepped in and helped the passengers." Castex, also a former French prime minister, said there had not been any indication of any problem with the barriers at the level crossing, adding that a lower speed train had passed through minutes earlier. The region's president, Xavier Bertrand, described the incident as a terrible tragedy. A passenger on the train told La Voix de Nerd that some people had broken their noses due to the impact. Elliot, who had been commuting to Paris for work, described seeing windows breaking and passengers hitting their heads, adding that he was lucky in comparison. The regional rail network Terre Haute de France said direct services between Béthune and Lens have been suspended until Thursday, with trains taking an alternative route. Services on other lines in the area are gradually resuming, but with significant delays. Rail Union SUD Rail has called for total transparency regarding the investigation into the incident. The collision comes less than a fortnight after a person died in the southeastern Var region following a collision between a regional train and a truck. Collisions at level crossings in France are relatively rare, but much more common than in the UK. There were 89 incidents recorded in France in 2024, causing 20 deaths compared to 6 in the UK. More than 100 collisions were recorded each year in France in 2020, 2021, 2022, and 2023. So, tough story about the train collision in France. Take a look at a story. It's kind of from the world of sports. If you're a Tiger Woods fan, you know that last week Tiger was in a car accident. He rolled over his SUV, and it turned out that he was, he's been accused of being under the influence of narcotics. He has since, gone to Switzerland for treatment. And this is the reaction of Jason Day, who's a Australian golfer. The headline reads, "Selfish Woods put others in harm's way," says Jason Day. Former USPGA champion Jason Day says Tiger Woods was a little bit selfish and put other people in harm's way after the American great was charged with driving under the influence. Woods, 50 years old, was arrested and charged after clipping a truck and rolling his car near his home in Florida last month. The 15-time major champion, who was also charged with property damage and refusal to submit to a lawful test, was found with two white pills in his pocket, which were identified as hydrocodone, an opioid used to treat pain. He submitted a written plea of not guilty by his lawyers last week and was granted permission by a judge to seek treatment overseas. While Australia Day criticized Woods' actions, the 38-year-old also said he has sympathy for Woods. "He was my hero. He is my hero," said Day, who is preparing to take part in the Masters, which starts on Thursday. "The reason why I play golf is because of this tournament and Tiger. It's hard to see him go through what he's going through, and especially under the microscope. Excuse me. It must be hard to be who he is and have everyone look on, kind of down on him. The only thing that I don't understand is that it's a little bit selfish of him to drive and put other people in harm's way as well. But when you're the player that he was and how strong-willed he is, he thinks he can do almost anything, and that's probably why he's probably driving and a little bit under the influence." In the arrest affidavit, an officer wrote that Woods was sweating profusely, his pupils were extremely dilated, and his movements were lethargic and slow. Five times Masters champion Woods, whose last victory at Augusta came in 2019, will not be at Augusta National for the season's first major, and he has also turned down the role of United States Ryder Cup captain next year in Ireland. Nobody was injured in the crash, and Woods said he had not drunk alcohol that day. When asked by authorities if he had taken any prescription medication, he replied, "I take a few." Woods has had many operations during his career, including his seventh back surgery last year. Day, who was Masters runner-up in 2011, continued, "He has had 25 to 30 surgeries, and when you're going through that many procedures, it's painful coming out of those procedures. I've had procedures done, and I typically try and stay away from all that stuff because I just know that painkillers, there can potentially be a downfall to it. Granted, when I first look at that, I look at it and go, he's just a human being like everyone else, and we all have struggles. It's unfortunate." American Harris English was among those to pay tribute to Woods, who has not played a major since the 2024 Open and has started only five of the past 16 majors, two of which he was forced to withdraw from. "He is such a legend in this game, somebody I look up to," the American said. "I know he's going to get through this. He has a big fight ahead of him. He's a fighter. That's what he does." It will be the first Masters since 1994 that does not feature either three-time winner Phil Mickelson or Tiger Woods. Mickelson, 55, is stepping away from golf, quote, "for an extended period because of a family health matter." Let's be honest, without Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson in the events in golf, when they both step away, honestly, I feel it hurts the game of golf, said Patrick Reed, who won the Masters in 2018. But at the same time, we want them to come back and be healthy and ready to go. So I got to admit, I am a big fan of Tiger Woods, and it's just difficult to see the physical challenges he has had over his life. It's just, you know, you just wonder if he had been healthy all of his life, how successful, how much more successful he would have been. It's really is incredible to see that. This is an interesting story coming from India. The headline reads, India's top court hears challenges to a ruling on women's entry into the temple. India's Supreme Court is hearing petitions challenging a landmark 2018 order that allowed women of menstruating age into the famed Sabarimala temple in southern Kerala state. The nine-judge constitutional bench set up by Chief Justice Surya Kant will also consider other similar cases from different faiths. So the court's guidelines will also help decide whether women can be denied entry into the Parsi temples and the Muslim mosques, whether religious leaders can excommunicate people, and the legality of female genital mutilation. Legal experts say the court's decision will have far-reaching consequences for women's religious freedoms and right to enter places of worship. The petition challenges the landmark 2018 Supreme Court judgment, which struck down the ban on women of menstruating age from entering Sabarimala. Hinduism bars menstruating women from participating in religious rituals, regarding them as unclean. Many temples denied women entry during their periods, and several devout women voluntarily stay away, but Sabarimala prohibits entry of all women between the ages of 10 and 50. Dedicated to the Hindu deity Lord Ayyappa, the temple attracts millions of male devotees across the country every year. Many elderly women and young girls also visit the shrine. In their 2018 order, the top court judges said keeping women out was discriminatory and unconstitutional, as the right to practice religion is available to both men and women. Indu Malhotra, the only woman on the five-judge bench who has since retired, dissented with the majority verdict, saying issues of deep religious sentiments should not be ordinarily inferred with by the court. Notions of rationality cannot be invoked in matters of religion. The verdict saw massive protests in the state, and women who tried to enter the shrine were either sent back or, in some cases, even assaulted. The top court received a number of petitions requesting it to review the judgment and strike down the 2018 order. The court accepted the review petitions and, in 2019, set up a seven-judge bench to hear the case. That bench decided to widen the ambit of the hearings and include in the review a number of similar cases from other faiths. As some of the cases were issues of constitutional importance, a new nine-judge bench was set up in 2020 to hear the petitions, but it never made any progress because of the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. Announcing the new bench at the weekend, Chief Justice Surya Kant said its hearing will determine questions of law in the case. The bench includes Justice Bive Nagarantha, the lone female judge in the top court, who is due to become India's Chief Justice next year, and justices drawn from different faiths, castes, and regions. Reports say this careful selection of judges represents different genders, religions, castes, and regions, and will help lend wider legitimacy to a verdict that will inevitably traverse contested terrain. Legal experts say the decisions taken by the constitutional bench would set the precedent for adjudicating similar cases. In recent years, temples, mosques, and shrines that have cited tradition to keep women out for centuries have faced an unprecedented challenge from women's groups who say denying them entry violates their fundamental rights. Court cases have also been filed against denial of entry to Parsi women married to non-Parsis in the Fire Temple and the practice of female genital mutilation in the small community of Dawoodi Boris. In the run-up to the hearings, the Travancore Devasam Board, which manages Sabarimala, has urged the court to refrain from questioning faith-based practices. India's federal government has also told the court that they support the review petitions. The hearings are set to conclude on April 22nd. Very interesting story about what's going on in India with regard to the freedom of women to worship in the temples. Let's see what we can do. There's a couple of minutes left. There's a story here about AI. We'll take a look at this. Well, if I can find it, we are. Sorry about this. Here we are. We'll see how far we can get into this article. The headline reads, China is winning one AI race, the U.S. another, but either might pull ahead. In the second half of the 20th century, it was the race to develop nuclear arms that occupied some of the finest minds in the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Now the U.S. finds itself in a different kind of race with a different adversary, China. The aim is to dominate technology, specifically artificial intelligence, otherwise known as AI. It's a fight taking place in research labs, on university campuses, and in the offices of cutting-edge startups, watched over by leaders of some of the world's richest companies and at the highest levels of government. It costs trillions of dollars. And each side has its strengths, something Nick Wright, who works on cognitive neuroscience at University College in London, neatly sums up as a battle between brains and bodies. The U.S. has traditionally led on so-called AI brains, the world of chatbots, microchips, and large language models. China has been superior on AI bodies, robots, and in particular humanoid robots that look eerily like people. But now, with both sides anxious not to let their rival dominate, those advantages might not remain forever, and the race may yet to be transformed further in the coming years. On November 30th, 2022, the California-based tech firm OpenAI launched its new chatbot. In a six-sentence statement, the company announced they had trained a new model which interacts in a conversational way. It was called ChatGPT, and immediately the tech world was dazzled. You could go on any sort of social network, and there was just this flood of posts from people talking about all the different ways that they were using this new little text box that had appeared on the internet, says Bloomberg columnist Parmi Olson, the author of Supremacy, AI, ChatGPT, and the Race That Will Change the World. It was the birth of the first mainstream large language model, or LLM, and LLM analyzes vast quantities of text and data that already exists on the internet and uses it to learn patterns in how ideas are expressed. And now experts broadly agree that when it comes to so-called AI brains, the U.S. has the upper hand. Well, that's as far as we're going to get. I'm sorry. It's an interesting article. But we have reached the end of our time together. It's been a quick hour. I want to thank you for listening to the articles I've selected to read for you today. I hope you found them to be enjoyable and interesting. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have a chance to do that, I hope that life gives you many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.